It's just the team that's going to be able to figure it out, because almost every company that we've had that's been successful, if you look at the original IP and you look at the original area and then what actually drove the value, most times it didn't even exist at the time of the Series A investment.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Health Technology Podcast. My name is Christine Minotto, and I'm the director of the UCSF Rosamond Institute at the University of California, San Francisco. I interviewed James Eadie in front of our live audience on October 22, 2019. James is a partner at Santa Ventures and invests in early-stage healthcare companies. James earned his medical degree at Harvard Medical School, and soon after, he served as a major in the U.S. Air Force and completed two tours in Iraq. In this episode, we learn that he's always interested in the finance and management aspects of medicine. After his time in the military, while he was still practicing medicine, he completed a business degree at the University of Texas at Austin. And shortly after that, he joined Santa Ventures. Today, you'll hear James' approach to investing with a particular focus on team building. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And one more thing, are you a founder of a health technology startup looking for an industry partner or seeking funding from seed to Series A? Apply to the 2020 Rosamond Innovators by Tuesday, April 14. Applications are open on February 18, and details on our website at rosamondinstitute.org. Well, thank you, James.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Everybody can hear me, right? I thought it would be good to start. Some of you probably, don't know, what's your background. You have quite an interesting background. You have done a lot in short period of time. Maybe you can start from your background, where you come from. How do you end up at Sante?
Sure.
That's a long journey, actually.
Yeah. I'll try to take a long journey, make it short, make it interesting. So I originally went to school and as a biomedical engineer, went off to med school in Boston and was sort of research focused, did a clinical residency in emergency medicine at Mass General in the Brigham, and had a military commitment. The Air Force had paid my way through my undergrad at Michigan. And so in, 2004, I moved to San Antonio, which was right during the war time. And San Antonio is the large, both Army and Air Force level one trauma centers, the only two, and now they're combined as a single level one trauma center for the entire DOD. So it's a big academic center, standard for anybody who's, teaching at UCSF, except I showed up in fatigues and then changed into scrubs rather than just street clothes. But, that was a great experience. We went on business trips to Iraq, comparatively, sort of like coming to San Francisco during rush hour. And I really enjoyed it. In fact, was really thinking about maybe I would make the, stay in the military. My wife, after my second tour, kindly request that I reconsider my job choices or think about being single. And she's an OB and we had a, 18-month-old at home. And so that was, I quickly realized that I was not going to be a lifer in the military. And so we had an opportunity to move to Austin, got my MBA while still working clinically, now as a civilian. I was still really academically focused. And so I was working in San Antonio with the residents, same place, just now actually wearing civilian's clothes to go in and then put on my scrubs. And I had the MBA and I'd always loved business and had always, migrated towards the financial aspects, management aspects of medicine and whatever I had done. And so, starting the, MBA in 2008 and watching one of the first weekends when Lehman Brothers collapsed and you're like coming out of class at lunchtime and you're like on CNN you're like, wow, this is a very interesting time period to be in school, trying to think of what to do. And what I learned pretty quickly was that nobody shows up at you know, MBA schools looking for mid-career MD MBAs. So I was like, I don't know what quite to do. But fortunately, I met the team at Sante during this process and said, why don't you come in and spend some time with us? So a decade ago, and let's look at some opportunities to how we might work together. And I loved what Sante was doing. And Sante at the time, and what we've continued to do, is we're an early stage, sort of traditional early stage life science venture firm. 40% or so in med tech, 40% in biopharma, the remainder in services IT, a lot of company creation. And I, you know, quickly realized as a trained physician that I knew nothing about running a medical device company, despite all my thoughts that I knew everything. I realized that, you know, residency did not teach me anything about the FDA or what CE mark was like, or I had no idea what a quality system was or V&V testing or anything. And that trying to learn that, the people who were doing it were really, really smart. And I was clueless on what, even though I had no idea what 510K was or PMA. But
yeah, you're investors.
Well, this was at this transition point, right? So I was humbled. I was like, holy cow, this is really complicated stuff. And these people have done it for 20 years. So how the heck am I going to add anything? But at the early stage, what I really loved was, you know, when I started looking across our early portfolio, a bunch of cardiovascular companies. And if you remember back in 2009-10, that was a big FDA transition. Hey, do we go to Europe? Where do we do clinical studies? And I suddenly realized that the questions that each of the companies were asking, the strategy questions, were actually really similar. And I could study up on what one was doing, and all of a sudden I could have value. I couldn't spell 510K or pronounce PMA, but I could at least have, hey, if you're going to go to Europe, here's somebody you could talk to, or hey, we just had this experience, you know, learned it over here in this company, and maybe it's valuable here. I'm not sure what to do with it, but hey, there's value there. And oh, you want me to read clinical literature? I can do that. Let's go to the hospital and talk to a physician about whether this is useful or not. I was like, oh, I can fit there. So I immediately found at my time at Sante early on that role playing was a really a natural fit for my clinical engineering background. To where I could add value. And that's all I've always been about. Like, how do I bring value? I don't want to be a third wheel. So how do I just join a team, right? How do I become a valuable member of a team? And I suddenly realized I can do that in this way. And so I approached them, and in about 2010, I left clinical practice to sort of just a hobby. It was still practice all the way into this past year, sparingly, but joined as a full-time. And they said, hey, you know, we'd love to have you, but you're going to have to go back to residency, basically. You know, you're going to have to be reschooled. You know, once again, you're going to have to learn how to spell PMA, right? It's going to be an important thing.
So what did they do? Did they send you to school?
So I got sent to, you know, 101 venture school, right? Which is, you know, unlike medicine and you don't do rotations. You just have to be around the hoop. Mm-hmm. And you have to experience it, right? You can't go to the, how do you pull licensing technology out of a university until you actually do it? You can't say, how do you sell a company until you do it? How do you fix the management team, right? How do you transition from a preclinical to a clinical to a commercial stage company? And how do you go through that strategy? How do you think through it? How do you move on until you've actually experienced that? And so venture, unlike medicine, is very apprenticeship based. Mm-hmm. Medicine, while there is a component of it, medicine is very, you know, structured, right? There's you do this year one, you do this year two. And in fact, in year one, here's your 12 or 13 rotations you're going to do to learn these skill sets. Venture, on the other hand, is much more, you learn with the community you have around. And fortunately with Sante, I was able to get involved very early on with, you know, most of our medical device companies and was able to be there. And they were all at similar stages. And so, you know, I've been able to follow them through. And, you know, we've, you know, fortunately had a good ride with many of them and sold quite a few off this past, right, you know, 18 months, and got a whole new batch of them coming through. And it's, you know, so now the life cycle, you know, as everybody in the room knows, right, this life cycle is a very long life cycle. So you got to be in this space for a long enough time to see it. But it's really rewarding when you do.
Mm-hmm. So again, when you were in Sante, when you first started, you know, how do they give you that opportunity? It's like you're being exposed, right, basically, to do that. Is it because of your clinical skills? That's why. And then they kind of like, this is the area that, you know, you add value. And then along the way, you gain experience and knowledge.
I wish I could say it was really super well thought out and organized. It was much more of just, hey, here are issues that the portfolio companies are having. And jumping in, And it's no different than being in early stage startups, right? I mean, you look around, there's problems everywhere. And there's, you know, look around, there's three of you, and you're like, okay, we got to take out the trash. Someone's got to write the protocol. Someone's got to go figure this stuff out. And so by just jumping in and saying, hey, I can help out here, whether it's directly with it, whether it's, you know, building networks, relationships, hey, we've got to find out what are strategic things. Well, which strategic are we interested in getting input? Well, who do we know? I'll raise my hand. I'll try to show up and see if I can go and get an introduction to somebody at Medtronic who could give us some of that input. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how I'll do it, but I'll go figure it out. And in that process, very much like, you know, starting a company, you start building networks and you build relationships and you build friendships and you can go back to it again. So I, you know, got involved early on, and you do what you early do in venture, right? I mean, if it was an ER, someone crashing, having a heart attack, yeah, they'd say, hey, you're in charge, go. But otherwise, you know, I reported to someone a decade younger than me and had to share everything I was talking with. And, you know, of course, I got excited about every cool new thing that came about. And they'd be like, we've seen that 30 times. I'd be like, but it's the greatest thing. And they're like, we know. Come back to me in a year from now after you've seen 20 of them. And, you know, and then we can reevaluate it. And that's a lot of, you know, what I learned about the world of venture, and I think what is always so challenging, is that there's so many great technologies, great ideas out there. But then how do you sort through them? And, you know, and learning that my role was not to, you know, I couldn't be an operator. I was an operator by training. I was an operator by personality. When you're on the venture side, you're an advisor. Mm-hmm. I can't operate, right? I gotta find the best team and let them run it, right. And trust in that team. And I think coming from medicine, you know, learning how to work as a team and trust and say, hey, you got, you know, because in medicine, right, we write the scripts. The residents work for me. I would walk into an ER and I had 100 people in there and they were all looked to me to say, what do you want to do? You know, it doesn't work that way unless someone's looking at me saying, hey, are you going to sign a check for a Series A? Then for a moment they look at you, right? But after that, you know, I'm not there when they're doing all the testing and they're doing the stuff. We got to rely on each other. So that takes time, and it takes time to just get that experience so you understand the process and you've seen enough of it.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is just being around. Yeah, I come back to it. You got to show up, you got to raise your hand, show up, and you got to just see enough so that you start having pattern recognition so that each shiny new object is not, you know, you're not just, hey, there we go, or hey, this is it. You've actually seen enough, and that's, I think, the maturation process you have in venture.
Mm-hmm. So when you joined Sante, that was, now you guys are Fund 3 already.
Fund 3 now, yes.
And so when you joined Sante in 2000...
I started in 2009, yep.
Yeah. So has it always been like focusing in the early stage?
We've maintained our knitting, yes. So we started in, our first fund was 2006. So briefly, we're based in Austin, Texas. The team was originally the healthcare vertical from Austin Ventures. Austin Ventures at the time was a big private equity, was shifting more towards private equity. It was like $3, $4 billion under management. And so trying to do early stage life science when you were doing Home Away was one of the, you know, at the time, and it was didn't quite work. So the three founders of Sante spun out and moved down the street from AV under great relationships, still maintained great relationships with all of them, but said, hey, this is a different product and doesn't fit under the broader umbrella of AV. And so that was Sante Fund 1. I joined while we were raising Fund 2, and then we've closed a new fund this past year, a $250 million fund. But all three funds focus on this on early stage development. And that, it's an interesting thing, especially in the world of med tech these days, where you don't see it. You do see it in biopharma. But, you know, what we observed was that in sort of both deep science, deep analysis back in 2006 timeframe, and then have redone it several times, was that the deals that mattered, so if I put my investor hat, take my clinical hat off, right? I always have multiple hats. If it's, you know, if I put my investor hat on, and I think my job is to take investment from pension funds, firefighters, and teachers, and give them back money, more money than they gave me, and more money than they could have if they had put it into bonds or, you know, the S&P 500 fund, so that they can pay the retirement fund. That's my in the end, that's what I have to do. Getting to work with everybody and do healthcare is great. But the pension funds, if they go do Google, Facebook, or if they buy art, you know, if it's lumber and, you know, buying lumber, they don't care. Their employees, the retirees don't really care what they're actually buying. What they care is the retirement's there in 10 or 20 years. And so we have to go and say, here's our story of why you should invest in us as money managers and trust your, you know, the decisions to us. And so, you know, that's what we go out and do with raising the capital and what we look for. But when we looked at where do the best returns come from, going back to why do we do early stage, we came back and said, geez, you know, in the end, it's just a few deals that really make a fund. And it's those deals that you've been in early on. It's the deals you took a bet on, you weren't quite sure, and then they grow up. Too many deals, half the deals fail, right? So if you look at the stats, over half of the venture capital Series A's will return zero. And that's been put out by multiple people now. Another 20% or so will end up returning less than the capital drawn, which means you've got about 30% that is all your returns. And then if you look at the numbers that will return actually 10 times your money, right, which we think about, hey, we just sort of like, you know, well, WeWork's a bad example. That's gone the opposite direction. Take WeWork, you know, 2 months ago or whatever. Take you know, many of the towers around here. They're named after famous companies, right? You know, 10X was like, oh, of course we have it. It's less than, it's about 1% of all Series A dollars that will have a 10X return. Just 1%. I mean, that's crazy, right? You have 10 to 15 deals in a fund, and 1% of all deals will actually turn into that, which means the vast majority of funds will not have even a single 10X return, which if you talk to venture capitalists, they would, of course, oh, of course, I've got plenty of 6s, 10s, 20X, right? But we looked at the numbers and it just doesn't support it. So either you've got to bet on unicorns and hope that you've got a portfolio of them, which is, to me, is, you know, might as well go buy, you know, you can try that, but it's sort of like playing the lottery. Or you can build a portfolio where you've got really great opportunities and you recognize you got to go early because you got to own enough. And you've got to own, you know, and it's only a few of those deals. But if you come in late, if you're highly syndicated, you miss those windows. And so we have always done early stage. We love working with the entrepreneurs at that stage. But it's interesting. It's what I love to do, but it is also driven from a financial return model.
Right.
And continues to be supported. We look at it continuously, come back to, you know, what do we think? What's the market doing today? Are we in the right place? And we continue to come back with quite strong conviction that we are.
Yeah, I mean, like you guys definitely tend to invest first and sometimes by yourself before you bring syndicate in the next round. And you have really good success, good traction. And how do you choose well? What are the things that you...
The luck.
How do you know... I mean, why? How do you know which one to pick out of all the other shiny objects out there?
So...
Because if you look at all the last three, they're like, you're the first and you're the only one.
You know, I remember we've carried this conversation a long time, right? There's three, you know, important things that you're always looking for. One, I need to invest in a massive market opportunity. Big, big pain point that if it really works, we run the gauntlet and actually get this thing through the FDA, it actually gets out there, it's going to really move the needle, right? Two, do we have the best team in the world to do this, right? Is this the team that's going to be able to figure it out? Because almost every company that we've had that's been successful, if you look at the original IP and you look at the original area and then what actually drove the value, most times it didn't even exist at the time of the Series A investment. SME. So that's number two. And then number three, well, I guess there's only two things.
So, but for you to come in early when you said that, so you invest in the idea that actually does not turn out to be what it is then.
But it's the same space. So, you know, we did an investment in a company called Millipede, which was going after mitral. And it was, the thesis was, look, mitral surgery has done mitral repair for 30 years and a lot of literature on it. And you put an annuloplasty ring on the mitral annulus. And then we looked at $1 billion worth of companies probably raised and fumed at the time, back in 2011-12 timeframe, going after other options. The only thing that was actually working was at the time was MitraClip, which was doing Alfieri stitches. So a surgical predicate. Everybody else was trying to do chordal repairs, which was not much there. They're trying to do coronary sinus, which is not a surgical, harpoons across the valves. None of the surgeons. We just came back and said, look, mitral's huge, unmet need. Two, we've got a thesis that the surgeons have been doing it a certain way. Let's not try to invent a new way to do it. Let's try to do what the surgeons have done. And why? But then everyone says to you, but you can't do that with a catheter. And so we decided, let's tackle that risk. Let's not tackle the risk of you can't do that we don't know how it'll turn out. We know that if we could build a ring that would work like a surgical ring, that was probably going to work. We had no idea how to do it. So that was the thesis that we went with. Market was there. It took us some time to find the right team. Mm-hmm. So we started that. It was with Steve Bowling out of the University of Michigan. We started with a development team in Austin. We then moved the company early on in the development out here to the West Coast because we wanted more catheter experience. Mm-hmm. And then we ended up with Randy Leshinsky, who was the founder, but he was an advisor on the board because he was CEO of another company at the time called Claret Medical. And then he became available because he had transitioned from being CEO. So it was this, you look back at it, and it was like this dance for a long time until we got the right team, but we were always in the right space. And then we started making it. So the original IP and how we approached it really evolved. There was concepts there, but those concepts, when we look back and they're kind of funny, right? Mm-hmm. But that's just the journey you go on, right? That's the engineering team and the iterations and trying to work on. But we didn't veer off of mitral, for example. Mm-hmm. We had a company called LDR Spine that we sold to Zimmer that was originally in lumbar, and then it developed the best cervical spine technology. So the cervical spine technology didn't even exist when we made the original investment. So it was still spine. Spine was big. The team was really talented, and we knew that they could innovate in that area. We did one in biotech as well called AbVitro, which was a next-gen sequencing out of George Church's lab out of Harvard. Once again, incredibly big space of next-gen sequencing with a really talented founder who continually just was sort of on the cusp of that technology and this wave of understanding how to do sequencing, and it could sequence the entire immune response of individual cells. And that's the exact same time that CAR-T took off. Mm-hmm. And so it ended up getting acquired by Juno early on. But what Juno bought didn't exist. But if you trace it back, right, it was still the exact same team that was super talented going after an area that was really hot that gave them time. Mm-hmm. It gave them time to discover it and figure it out in that space. Had they been working in an area that was not exciting, they could have figured out how to, it would have been just as brilliant, but it would not have had the market excitement. Just like Randy doing Millipede, if it was in an area that was orthopedics today, right? If you're trying to go after orthopedics today, it's really challenging. Orthopedic companies are not buying early. You could have a great thing. It's a big market, but they're not buying companies early in orthopedics because the market itself has got limitations there.
Okay. This podcast is sponsored by Brown Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at brownratnick.com.
So, but you also mentioned that you focus on the team. So oftentimes you invest in a team that has a lot of track records rather than the first-time entrepreneur, or you bring in, you like the technology, you like the founder, but they don't have quite the right experience, and then suddenly bring the team together.
It always depends. We try to identify what does this company need right now for this stage? And as the companies evolve, they need more talent, right? Early on, most of the device companies need a really strong clinical lead, which may be a founder mm-hmm. who just understands that, what the surgeon needs to solve for. And then they need a really strong engineering team. Mm-hmm. But that engineering team may be one or two people early on. But then as that grows, then you're like, hey, now I need somebody strong clinically. Mm-hmm. Right. Eventually, if you take it to a point where you say, hey, that team that was great engineering-wise, and if you were to come in at that point, you'd say, but now we're moving into a phase of a lot of clinical development. Mm-hmm. And really the skill here is clinical strategy and clinical ops. I got to run big clinical studies. That's a different skill set. Mm-hmm. And maybe you need to augment the team, whether that's at a board level, whether that's at a CEO level, right? Many times you see the founders move to become VP of R&D, or they become the chief technology officer. Or you see, wholesale CEO swaps at those times. Or it's going to be commercial. Right? They just got FDA approval, but you're going to have to run this thing commercially. You see those things. So we look at each one of them for the stage that it's at, the skill set that's around the table, and what do we think, together. And it's clear. It's not like, what do I think? It's partnership, sitting down with the entrepreneur, sitting down with the team and talking, okay, you want $5-10 million. What are we going to do with that? Mm-hmm. Who are the people that we want to hire? Who do you have around the table today? Who do we need to bring into the table? If we're going to bring $10 million, how do we then secure around the table to put the best people we can mm-hmm. for the stage of the company? Mm-hmm. Right? I don't need for first in human clinical stage company somebody who runs multinational PMAs. Right. That's actually not the right person. I also don't need a CEO who's taken a company to $100 million unless they really wanted to go back early. That's not their skill set. And in fact, that would be a challenge. Like if you come in and say, hey, here's a CEO who runs a $100 million company and wants to do this new startup, I'd be like, Christine, that doesn't fit, right? We got to have someone take out the trash. They're used to having like a trash, they don't even know what trash is, right? Like that scope and scale, it doesn't work. So it's at the stage of the company of where it's at. And then it's the job of the board, the job of the CEO, the team, to constantly review that mm-hmm. and think about it. That's the strategy part. That's the stuff I love. How do you block and tackle? How do we build? And how do we evolve? Because we each evolve into different roles and we need different skill sets. I'll look, for example, if we're going to do it's a software company, then I can bring the medical expertise, but I'm not going to bring any of the expertise in the software. So I'd be looking around as an investor saying, hey, we need to have somebody on the board, probably an investor who understands software. Mm-hmm. Or if we're going to go to a really long stage commercial, because I'm an early stage guy, mm-hmm. I would come in and say, who do we know that's super smart with commercial stage companies? That's the investor we want now, because mm-hmm. they could provide that guidance. They probably have the network of the best VPs of sales. They know that they've taken 5 companies public at this stage. That's the thing. So it's constantly reevaluating it. And I think for me, it's easy because I'm pretty comfortable that I don't know a lot. So asking for who's really smart to be surrounded by it, for me, it's super easy. And I love being around teams that do the same thing. That just are incredibly humble and just say, look, let's just get the best people in here to do it. And, we got plenty of issues we got to go solve. So, it's not in here that we got to solve these issues. We need the best people here because it's tackling it out there that's the challenge.
Yeah. So I think also being an early stage investor, I think there's a lot more rolling off your sleeve compared to the later stage investor in providing a lot of the guidance to the founders. That's probably one of the key contribution besides funding, probably working with them.
Yeah, there's definitely a different relationship that, I'm sure you all have the experience, right? That early, either early investor, early board members have with a founder. When there's 3 people on a team, they're going to call somebody. There's there's only 3 people we can call. That relationship's very different than when it gets to a later stage company and you've got a board of, 4 or 5 different investors. You got 7 people on the board. CEOs then spend a lot of time managing their boards at that point. So there's different, those are different relationships, absolutely.
I mean, we had Tony came give a talk about Claret story, and he's comparing the Claret story with the emphasis. And one thing that he was talking about how failing a clinical endpoint, yet still managed to get the FDA approval. And I thought having the very supportive board also helped that. To make it happen, maybe you can give some color from the investor point of view. I was about to have Azeen come next month, so I'm going to touch everybody.
Exactly. Well, so for those who are, the quick story. So Claret Medical, embolic protection for TAVR, now acquired by Boston Scientific about a year plus ago. Tony was the COO, Azine was the CEO. So Azine is fantastic. So I'm glad she's coming, and Tony is fantastic. We had a real pucker moment, and I still remember it very vividly because I was had just dropped my, you know, gotten home with my kids, and I got a call, and it was May timeframe, and I get the phone rung, and it was the chair of the board, and said, "Hey, we got to talk." We just unblinded the clinical data, which we completed this big, nearly 400-patient clinical study looking at, you know, the effects of using an embolic protection during TAVR and whether or not we had reduced the lesions to the brain. And, you know, all prior clinical work had suggested that you did. For a lot of interesting stories, this study turned out to be much more complicated than we'd expected. A lot of lessons learned there, but it was a time when there was a lot of different valves coming on the market. So if you know the cardiovascular space well, it was the original Sapien XT that then became S3, core valve and core valve to Evolut. And you had multiple, so you ended up with four different valves in a study. And if you go back to basic statistics, you know, you're trying to measure one endpoint, having four different valves coming in, giving you different performance, is, you know, and by the way, the study was designed for XT only because it was the only valve in the market at the time. And thus, it turns out that the valves did not all function the same. And so what that meant was that when you pooled the data, especially at the first pass, looked ugly. And so there's three primary endpoints to the clinical study. Two of them, safety, phenomenal, passed, but the MRI measurement didn't. And so we were sitting with about 2 months worth of cash in the company. We had been sort of thinking, hey, we've been fighting upstream because there was a lot of resistance in the space to whether or not, in questions, whether you, clinically you needed embolic protection at all, and if so, then which patient. And so, you know, we thought the study was going to be positive. We were super excited about it, and we get the call that it was negative, but that the study was so complex that the team really needed, you know, 6 to 8 weeks to try to figure it out and even understand what this meant. And so, yeah, that was a really challenging moment of trying to think through as I paced. I literally must have paced for 2 hours in my front yard on the call. My kids were like, "Are you going to be fed?" And I'm like, "No, you're fending for yourself, guys. So sorry." I think my wife was on call. And so I stood out there literally pacing my front yard going, this can't be happening. And what ended up coming out of that was belief in the team, belief in Azine. And she's like, "Look, I need this time. I need it. You know, I need this time to understand this. This is a complex story. I can't tell you what this data means. We're surprised by it, but we need time to look into it and understand it. So please don't make an irrational decision today." Support from the board, chairman of the board, Fred Khosravi, tremendous guidance there, and then a syndicate. So Hank Plain from Lightstone and myself. So that was the board, and Nick Hopkins, who is a clinician, neurosurgeon, and you know, basically Hank, you know, Hank and I, who were writing the big checks, just sort of said, "Hey, do we believe in the management team? Do we still believe in this opportunity? Do we understand enough of what's going on that is this worth, you know, just killing it today, or do we believe there's something here?" And we believed in the team. We believed in the space. Did not know whether we were putting money in that we would look at in 2 months and say, or, you know, 6 months later and say, we just wasted $1 million, $2 million on top of what we'd already, you know, we'd all been in 10 plus million that we'd been writing off completely. But it took a lot of communication, a lot of sort of working through a lot of emotion, as people do, and then sitting down and coming up with a plan. And saying, "Okay, we'll put a bridge note in place. Okay, we get that. Let's get that going. You know, how much time does the team need?" And so the structure got put in place. And then what ended up happening is the team dug into the data. In many of these things, in many of these studies, if you think about, this happens actually quite often in clinical studies. Just there was a lot of learning that went on. That's why you run clinical studies. And so while the study wasn't designed specifically to look at specific endpoints, findings came out of that. And so that then led to presenting that set of data to the clinical community, and the clinical community saying, "Hey, if you look at this data, what you used to be asking for MRI, which is what we thought we wanted to, you should be looking at acute strokes within the first 7 days. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that, you're cutting stroke rates by 63%. and you're cutting it in every valve type, you're cutting it in across all the data cuts to it, that's phenomenal. Like, that's a stroke signal that wasn't designed for it, but it's there in all, you know, 99% of the filters have debris in it. And so when we saw the clinical community start to jump into it, so Marty Leone was the clinical lead there, said, this is real, right? So then that was the next point. Okay, we've got something. We got to take it forward. And so we then put together a series, whatever we were, we put a financing together and said, let's get this thing, you know, through the FDA. Mm-hmm. We had to go to panel. That was incredibly rough on the team. And then had to do some early commercialization because people weren't there. But it's that, you know, in hindsight, it looks great. I can say we've also done this and we've shut the companies down afterwards because we thought we would give it another shot. But it comes out with trust. And I'll tell you, that trust is not earned, or that trust is not developed when you're in the crisis. The trust came because you'd spent years together. People have been thoughtful. They had listened. You'd gotten to know each other. And I just, you know, and also just the temperament, mm-hmm. right? The temperament of the other investors, the size of the funds, where this was. We're in this together, you know, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to be the one who says I'm tanking this. Mm-hmm. You know, we're together. And people did not take out their sharp elbows. I wish I could say that that's the case all the time. I would actually say it's probably, it's not as common as you would hope. Mm-hmm. When stress hits and people are looking at those things, sharp elbows can come out. Right. But this was one that really worked out great. And the company took off, right? When we sold the company to Boston, it was on a $25 million run rate with a sales team of four. Mm-hmm. So most companies, if you can do $2 million in a mature sales force per year per salesperson, that'd be eight. We had $25 million with a sales force of four. It was flying off the charts. So, I mean, it had this near-death episode. Yeah. This near-death episode was rolling for a long time, which challenged us each strike. There was no clarity during any of this. So I know you guys were out there and you think, oh, it's so clear. It's not. It's this thick as freaking mud. It is stressful. Because then, you know, I got to go back to my partners and convince them why we need to put more money in, right? And by the way, we're writing checks along. So I'm asking them not only just, hey, from the fund, but like, I need you to write a check, right, into this and trust me. And here we go. And by the way, we won't really know for another 3 to 6 months. And then even at that point, like, so these things are, but that's success. I mean, that's the funny part about it is that's what success looks like, is the companies nearly fume multiple times. They look like they're going to go off the rails. They'll never get funding. The FDA will never approve it. We failed our clinical endpoint. How could it be anything beneficial? And then it hits the market and...
It's like almost like a Cinderella story.
It is like a Cinderella story. But I think it's much closer to most med device stories than they just are, you know, rocket ship up. I'm still waiting for that rocket ship up, right? Because I haven't seen that one. I've seen just the rocky roads, and, you know, and then at the end you look like, you know, you either look like a fool or you look brilliant, but it's neither.
I think the press always make it sound like very easy, smooth ride.
Yeah, I always joke, it's the 13 year overnight success.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for listening today, and don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.